Hi, this is Matt Newman. I went from a career in computer science and programming to running a global sales organization, so I know a thing or two shifting into a sales leadership role and how to build a team around what sales is really all about. If you want to learn how to transform your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, significantly increase your revenue, and create a scalable sales system, you should be listening to the Authentic Persuasion Show with my good friend Jason Cutter.
Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another guest episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. So my special guest today is Matt Newman. Matt is the global head of sales for Institutional Shareholder Service. Matt is responsible for driving client retention and sales growth for the ESG, governance and proxy voting, data analytics, and securities class actions businesses. So all of that in there, I'm sure we'll touch on some of that. A member of the ISS leadership team. So Matt partners with businesses, product, and marketing to define and execute go-to-market strategies for the broad suite of services they provide. What's fascinating about him and what I'm excited to talk about is that at one point he was in computer science and programming and then ended up running global sales organization, which is quite a different leap, one that I can relate to, but he's doing it well and super excited for this. Matt, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thank you. And I do have to, before we dive into things, note that because of regulatory requirements, I have to say that the comments in the show are my own and that of the firm that I work for. So I've dotted my I's and crossed my T's before we begin. So thank you for having me.
Perfect. And disclaimer noted. I love that. Appreciate it. And excited to dive into this. So share a bit about that journey, because I think this is a good one to start with. And I have so many questions and thoughts around it that I wouldn't say it was a leap. I don't know if it was a leap, if it was an instant leap, or it was just a progression over time. But going from computer science programmer to global sales leader.
Yeah. And if you had told me 25 years ago, this is the job I would have, I would have told you, you were absolutely out of your mind. So yeah, I was a computer engineer. So I started out, I was a techie. I loved building servers. I'd spend hours programming. I loved it. I went to school for it. And what ended up happening is I did some time, worked for a period of time at the Big Five, which at the time was Anderson Consulting. So I'm dating myself a little bit, but we all sort of saw the writing on the wall and a bunch of us got together and spun a company out to do web development, application development consulting. So we ended up building a business and I was really on the technical side at the time, running projects, working with clients, working with customers, while some of my other colleagues were working on the business side. So I sort of cut my teeth and learned the business side of things, just having to deal with customers. And we grew that business to 30 people. We ended up selling it. And after that journey ended, I found myself in financial services and really implementing projects in the financial services space at a company at that time called RiskMetrics. And really, I took a number of different roles as I grew through the company, as the company grew through acquisitions, both on internal product development, external product development. And over time, I kept gravitating towards the front office, towards customers. I was learning to work with clients. I was learning to help close deals. And I didn't take the traditional sales approach. I was very sort of analytical in how I did things. And then an opportunity came up really to move to sales. And I had done some of that when I ran my own shop. You can't really avoid the sales process when you're running your own firm, but it was sort of this gradual progression of moving from sort of left to right. And then in sales, I found I was constantly improving things, identifying process, ways to streamline the sales process, way to help train and improve the skills of the people I work with and on my team, coincidentally turn out to be the leaders of a skills of a sales leader, which is really taking an analytical approach and ultimately migrated there. What's fascinating is, I want to say is it the leader of HubSpot? Mark Fabergé? I think I got his name wrong, but he was also an engineer who became sort of a sales leader. And he said it was kind of that same journey of you're analyzing things and trying to find ways to get in front of customers, help improve the customer process. And those things, even though an engineering perspective are analytical, they actually help from a sales leadership perspective.
So one of the things that I know to be true, and you even mentioned this to me when we talked before, is that usually people on the engineering side, on the programming side, the technical side, operations, processing, fulfillment, customer service, generally have a view of what selling means and what salespeople do. And if we're going to just call it what it is, what salespeople have to do to close deals. There's an impression of what a salesperson's going to do to people in order to make their numbers and close deals. Do you remember what that was that you were thinking? Because I'm sure you had that feeling.
Yeah, it was probably the car salesman, black back slapping, overbearingly gregarious individual that I wasn't. I was more of an ambivert or introvert. And that was your perspective of what sales was. And that changed over time. It's like you say, you realize in the real world, that doesn't work anymore. People don't want to buy from someone who's like that. They want to buy from people who listen, who understand the customer problems, who don't push solutions where they're not needed, but really look for where there's a problem to solve and there's a mutual benefit. I think that stigma is still in the workplace. I think it's still out in the world today.
It's out in the world today. And unfortunately, it's there for a valid reason, because many organizations, many salespeople still feel like that's how they must operate. Many sales leaders and managers still run their teams in that same way. I made a line in my book that even my editor's like, do people actually say that? And I said, yeah, which is find them, fleece them, and forget them, right? Yeah. That's still a model. That's still it's a thing terrible. That salespeople do. I come across them all the time, even pockets within an organization or whole organizations where they're still running that boiler room, Wolf of Wall Street mentality, no matter what they're selling. And so unfortunately, my mission, which is to shift that so that prospective customers have a different experience and excited to deal with a salesperson, it still happens. Here's what I think is fascinating and I love about your story, which is why I knew that I wanted to have you on the podcast the moment we started talking, is I firmly believe that someone with your background coming from where you did on the computer programming and engineering side, the technical part, actually makes a more effective salesperson, because you're not trying to sell anybody, because you don't feel like you want to be selling someone. You just want to help people, and you know which tool in the toolbox could help them if you find that need.
Yeah, that's an interesting assessment. It's funny, because when you're looking for talent, which is obviously the biggest challenge any leader faces these days, is good talent, is that I was always of the impression that I had to be pushy, that I had to be overbearing. And my journey to get into sales was exactly like you said. I found that I was more successful and my customers were happier. And the person outside the table is happier when you're listening and you're not trying to push something they don't want. You're trying to assess the situation. You're trying to understand an environment that's good for both sides of the table. Because when that works, everyone's happy and it's a long-term relationship. And it's those long-term relationships that those are the winning ones over time. You had that great expression earlier. You try to get a deal done and leave it. That's a terrible way to run a business. The most successful firms today are ones that have long-term customer partnerships that run for decades. And you can't do that if you're really looking at things at a transaction level. It fails miserably.
And that piece in there, and what I think is so important, which is why I do what I do and why I wrote the book, is to address that and help people make that leap, which is the people who don't think, they don't want to get into sales. They don't like what sales is about. They want to help people, but they have this misconception. And then what I love most is what you said and where you've come from, which is you didn't want to sell. You had this illusion of what sales is like, but you knew you could help people. And so when you do that, it takes that pressure off. It takes that, I've got to do this and this, and I've got to twist arms and slap backs, and I've got to convince and use tactics, instead of just like, okay, what are your problems? Okay, I have the solution or not, and I want to help you. And it's a different intention. Let's talk about either your experience or top sales reps, people that you've experienced, especially coming from your background, which I think is fascinating. What are some of the top traits, personalities, activities that you found work for you and or you see for other top salespeople that might not be, let's say, the traditional salespeople?
Right. It's a great question. And I'll tell you, we've spent a lot of time, my team, trying to find, because you want to find the right person, right? You want to find a person that customers are going to relate to, that are going to enjoy working with, that can also perform at a high level. We look for things, or at least, again, we as in me, right? I want to say that these are my perspective, but I find that I look for things. I look for humble sales reps. I look for reps that are constantly looking for ways to improve themselves. And I think that discipline of continuous improvement and the ability to sort of have the confidence to go in a room and be comfortable in a room full of strangers and present, but at the same time to be humble and to take coaching advice and guidance, it's a rare find. And be able to have someone who has the delicate balance between the two. And then you need to marry it with all these sort of other intangibles, the ability to be disciplined. I mean, you know, you come from a sales background. You don't just sort of come in, make 3 phone calls, write a couple emails, and then just the cash register rings. No, it's discipline, building relationships with people, finding things that are meaningful for customers, making tons of phone calls, and doing that over and over again on a daily basis for long periods of time until an opportunity presents itself. And then working cautiously and patiently with a customer to navigate them through the buying process. And that requires discipline. It requires attention to detail. It requires follow-up, good presentation and communication skills, a balance of listening. All those skills have to marry together until you find the right person. And it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, that is definitely a challenging combination to find. Usually what happens is you find somebody who has lots of experience, but they're very set in their way, right? And I talk about this a lot, which is that what I consider a healthy ego and an unhealthy ego, right? The healthy ego is that confidence you're talking about, but still open and humble. I love that you use the word humble about it, is humble confidence. And then the unhealthy ego is, I know everything. I don't need any help. Don't tell me what to do. I'm the pro. Let me do what I do best mode. Yeah. Which, again, unless they're really amazing, but then I found if they're really amazing, why are they looking for a job? And it's like, okay, then something's not right. But I love that humble confidence of what you said, because go do a presentation, but then turn around and be able to get feedback about that presentation and then always looking to improve. For me, that's a sign of a professional, right? Professional athlete who plays and then they spend 60% of their time off the court or off the field watching game footage of themselves, of others, practicing, figuring it out, always learning, always trying to grow. That's an awesome sign. I love that.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point. I mean, LeBron James has a coach, right? You're thinking to yourself, this guy is the best basketball player to possibly ever walk the earth. Maybe go on hours about him and Michael Jordan, right? He's a coach. Yeah. You're thinking this guy knows everything, right? No, the guy's got a coach. And so I take input from people. I think, like you said, in this world where, I mean, everything changes so fast. You could be at the top of your game today, and there's a technology that can either disintermediate you, or there's a way that customers want to buy that you didn't see coming, right? So that, like you said, that ego, where I know everything, it just, you can't survive in a world today if you've got that perspective. So,
and what's interesting too, is that if we look biologically and mentally and historically, right, as a species, we were at one point very primal, and that primal part of our brain is still there, that survival amygdala part that has these animal instincts and fears and drives. I mean, if you were, let's say, a caveman or woman thousands and thousands of years ago, and you just were stuck in your routine and did the same thing all the time, you were going to die, right? Like, it was adapt and overcome and deal with whatever or die. The world is just so comfortable that people just get into this, like, okay, I'm just going to be comfortable and stable and do what I do and only what I do. And there's no such thing as stable, in my opinion.
You're 100% right. I mean, think about the tools. Like you said, Calendly, who saw that coming, right? Well, maybe you guys get, maybe you did. But if your competitors are starting to use tools like that or tools that make it easier to buy, you're going to be out of a job pretty soon if you're not adapting yourself. And that's it. If you're the caveman and you know, everyone else can light a fire and then the storm comes and you can't, you're out. That's it.
Yeah. And to your point about new technologies and new ways that customers want to interact and or buy, I think that one's huge, because a lot of salespeople get into, I just do phone calls, I just do emails, or I only do face-to-face meetings. Obviously, this is the year of no face-to-face in 2020. But people who are like, I don't do any of that stuff. I only do face-to-face. That's how I close all my deals. And not even the world, but sometimes the buyers just change and say, I don't care. Just call me, or let's do a video call. And your competitors are willing to meet the customer where they want to be met at least in the beginning of the relationship. Then you're going in. Somebody else is making fire and your tribe is going to die out.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't evolve your sales approach, if you didn't lean on technology in a way that you've never had to before, and you didn't do it quickly, I mean, you were underwater and you're looking for air very quickly. You're absolutely right. It was a remarkable year for that.
So for you, right, let's talk about it. Everyone knows the challenges right now. I'm not even going to go into that and take up our precious time talking about the challenges of virtual teams, of remote teams. You have a global workforce, sales teams all over that at some level you're interacting with. I know that you have theoretically a local office full of people that you would normally go in and interact with. Now it's all remote. What have you done to succeed? Like, what things have you found? What evolution have you made in that leadership style for the leaders who are listening or watching and still kind of struggling or looking for new tips? Is there anything that you found that works well for you?
Yeah, and I'll be the first to tell you, I'm still learning. I'm still realizing there's things that I haven't done this year that I could have done better. Number one, I think, was without sort of giving sort of homage to one tool or another, I think we quickly learned that a tool like Microsoft Teams that allows collaboration, video, audio, sharing of information, so that everything everyone needs to work on is in one place, and a way to use communication tools that are instant has been critical. And it could have been Slack, it could have been Teams, it could have been any of those. And then using it to make sure you're doing video calls with people, you're over communicating, right? And I think it's so easy, even in a world where you see people, where if change is happening or there's issues you need to resolve, that you don't reach out to everybody. People find out about things through rumor or hearing it through the grapevine. So making sure when I'm trying to roll change out or I'm trying to communicate important, let's say competitive intelligence in the marketplace that we can take advantage of or we should be aware of for a defensive play, making sure everyone is aware of that has been some of the hardest things I've had to deal with this year. So using tools like the instant messaging feature in Teams that everyone's on so people get pop-ups, using video recordings of team meetings because people can't be there all the time and sharing content through video, that's been a huge eye-opener for me that I spend probably 75% of my day just communicating things to people. And that's probably the thing that's kept us most together, I think.
It's so important what you said too, because there's been times where I'm at an organization in a leadership role and I find out about something happening in another department because I happen to bump into somebody in the hallway in passing. And then we're having a conversation, just random, like just random. And then they mention something and it's like, that would have been good to know. Why didn't I know that? And if I hadn't saw them in the hallway or at the lunchroom or in the parking lot, I literally might not have never known about that initiative, that change, that issue, that problem, whatever it is. So I think a lot of times people in person, in organizations, like you said, they get lazy with the communication because they just think, oh, everyone's here, so I just don't need to talk about it. But then it creates a silo, this terrible information silo. And yeah, most people don't like overly communicating and it feels weird and terrible, but that's so important. So I'm glad that you discovered that and shared that with the value of that. Just keeping everybody overly communicated so that there's no mistakes and then people can absorb what they need to absorb.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's almost like the channel that your team is communicating on in Teams has become the water cooler. And I'm actually thinking I should probably just change the icon for that to be like a giant water cooler at this point.
That's it's awesome.
Amazing because that's where you go. I need to know what's going on. Guys, just post on that channel. If you see something, see something, say something, right? But you know, you hear about competitive intel, you hear about a change in how we go into market, or you hear about really some new service that's launching that we think will be incredibly impactful, go to that channel and post. That's been huge.
And I think that's the value when you look at this kind of situation that nobody wanted, that a lot of people struggled with adapting to. A lot of leaders are struggling with this remote spread out. How do I lead? The value though comes in when you have this centralized channel that you would never have in an office under normal circumstances or initiated. Is you have the water cooler, but only who's at the water cooler at any one time and what kind of information. And I've always done that with sales teams where you have this one rep who's doing well and there's something that's working for them, but nobody else knows about it because we're not talking about it. So as a leader, you've got to like figure out what they're doing, make a meeting out of it and share that with everyone, this best practices. And now you could just dump it into one place. It's like, okay, what did you just do for that sale, Kim? Oh, I did this. Oh, that's great. Now everybody knows instantly and everyone can start experimenting with it.
Yeah. And that's what's hard is, again, doing that virtually was such a huge leap. It used to be, oh, someone would come to the office. We had this wonderful meeting. Here's what went well. We just learned these things. We learned about, you know, when we're sitting with a customer, these are the things that they really like about our products. And we were able to sell our product in a way we didn't see before, it's all gone. You lose that. So how do you communicate that in a world where you're on a video chat or you're just on you're on text? It just changed the whole dynamic. And that's what a high-performing team is based on, is that interaction. And so that's very hard to do. I think we've learned how to do it, which is I say frightening in a good way.
Well, and then when, if the world goes back to any kind of normal in person, in office, different organizations have different feelings about it. What I see is now this new muscle and this new ability has been created over this long term, however long this goes. And then hopefully that over communication, that water cooler, that virtual collection of knowledge will just enhance the in-person interactions if it does go back that way. And everyone just have this new thing they bring with them.
Yeah. It's funny too. The other sort of side effect was, make sure I'm using a virtual background here because I didn't even follow my own rule, but you don't realize like your own personal workspace and the neatness of it you're being judged on a daily basis. So note to self in the virtual world, make sure you keep a neat background.
And at the same time, yes, you want to have a neat workspace and it's life. And so you do enough of these calls, you get to peer into the bedrooms and living rooms and offices of people. And that's the nice thing about this situation is that it's global. Everybody's affected. Nobody's away from this. And so the empathy level from me is so high, which is right now, if you had a family member walk in the middle of this, it's life. Anyone listening, they can relate. It's just exactly. The real world. I recorded one the other day with somebody. He stood up. He was wearing track pants, but a nice shirt on top. And it was like, that's life, right? That's just what people are dealing with. It's exactly. So much more human than the kind of illusion. So anyway, one of the other things that we talked about before when we first chatted was that your team success, your sales success, and just your feelings about it in general, generally not based on the Glengarry leads. Literally, that's the note I wrote in there. Yeah. Talk about the Glengarry leads and how it's, let's say, it's not about the leads.
Yeah, it's not. Everyone thinks that it's, you have sort of the best territory, you have the best leads. I think that world is gone, right? I think you're in a position today where customer needs are changing, right? It's about building relationships and building trust with customers. So when they become the person with a need or the old school sort of Glengarry lead, right? You're ready for them. And I think there's this notion in the world that everyone is ready to buy your product at the same time. It's either A or B. And no, everyone's in a different, depending on the everyone's stage or journey to build relationships with people, understand what their needs are. And then when they are ready, you're there for them. And I think it's been an interesting, you know, you talk to people, you talk to folks, hey, I'm struggling this quarter hitting my number. And then you look at, you know, who they're working with and what they're doing. And it could be that customers aren't ready. They're not at that stage in the journey where they want to buy something or they need something. And that's okay. You shouldn't pressure them, but you're educating them so that when that time comes, they're ready. And I've seen some people I've worked with over the years that are just absolutely amazing at it. People who work with someone for 5 years before that customer's ready. And it's not even just in my company, it's friends I have in the space and ex-colleagues who've moved on. The most successful folks are people who are not looking for that transaction, but they're looking to, hey, stay in touch. I think certainly Adam, a mutual friend of ours who runs NetworkWise, he's a genius at it. It's about building a network of people, understanding what their needs are, where are they in their life cycle, for wherever they are. And then one day the light bulb goes off. Hey, I have an interest in that product or service, and I know the person who can help me with that. So that's been the difference.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. And obviously anybody who knows me knows that I fully agree with that, which is it's that long term. And I come from a background where sometimes it's a mostly one call close, B2C, mostly transactional. It's a service, so there will be some fulfillment later on, but the salesperson has their conversation and then they're pretty much done. They will never talk to that person again. And the most successful ones, and even myself in those roles, looking at it long-term, thinking relationship long-term, even if I never speak to them again. And when you do that, even in your own life, right? You see someone at the grocery store or the checkout person, right? You treat them like it would be a long-term relationship, even if you'll literally never see them again. It just changes the conversation and the approach and the energy for me. And then it just leads to different results. So I love that you said that. One of the things though, and this is where that's great, long-term relationships, that sounds nice in theory, Matt. Okay, that's great. Yeah, sure, that's fine. But how do you deal with your competitors in the space and or just the noise that's just hitting your prospective customers all the time, right? Either direct marketing or just the noise of the space. How do you get through that? How do you even get a chance to develop those relationships or move that forward?
It's hard. I think literally that battle is every day. So if it's someone you don't know and trying to get in front of someone, the only way you're going to rise above the noise, and this is true in life, whatever, is to create value for the person. If they don't feel like you're adding any value, you're going right in the garbage can. And how you create value for someone is you have to spend a lot of time thinking about it. You have to spend a lot of time thinking about the message you send, the sort of the thought leadership you produce, and the value that you bring to customers. And I think there's so much that comes at you. I mean, even I do it. I've got my list of emails. When they come in, I immediately just hit swipe left. You're in the garbage. I don't even look at it anymore. And I think it might've been one of your podcasts I listened to. There was someone on it. I can't remember which one it was, but the woman was saying, she's like, everyone knows ahead of time who to throw in the garbage can. And they're too lazy to unsubscribe because the amount of effort it takes to unsubscribe is so great. It's just easier to sort of swipe left. I talk a lot about this with my folks. When we're going to reach out to a customer or have an interaction, it's got to add value or it's got to do something that piques curiosity to the point where they want to engage with you. Education, thought leadership, those are the kinds of things that the companies that are really winning. And I think about the people that, and you probably get this too because of your position and you're a thought leader in the sales space, is people want to sell to you. And I think about the people that are selling to me, the ones that sort of jump to my mailbox are the ones who know me, the ones who understand what my needs would be, but aren't so pushy that they drive me crazy. Yeah, you got a great idea, but you're driving me nuts. Can you stop calling me? So that's a very delicate balance. And to do it right takes a lot of thought and a lot of effort.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when I get those, especially when I get the, I'm reaching out to you for the third time, I just called you as well. And if I don't hear back from you, then I'm going to stop reaching out. I'm like, excellent. I'm glad you picked up the hint that I am not interested. And that's the challenge. And I see that. And I try to be mindful of that as well. And obviously, I've tried very hard to not be a hypocrite, which is I don't like those cold emails, those instant sales pitches. So I'm not going to do that. That's why I don't do a lot of cold outreach. I more build relationships, interact with people, provide value, get to know somebody first. And if it's even worth talking to, right? I'm not going to just pray and spray, which for some organizations work, but then it leads to this thing. And then a super side note for anybody listening, if you want I won't say a hack because that sounds too serious, but if you want a tip for your email, what I've done in Gmail specifically, and it works in most others, is I have a filter into a special email folder where if unsubscribe is in the email, which means it's a mass email, it goes into that folder, not in my inbox, and I can look at all those later and or delete all of them later. So I have, it never hits my inbox. My inbox is clean and I have 300, 400, 1,000, and then I'll go in there, see if there's anything relevant. If not, delete them all at once. And then they don't even come across my radar unless I want to. So anyway, that's a good tip I got from Mr. Ari Mizell, who's an amazing productivity guy. So for your business, your team is selling to other companies, right?
Correct.
So you're interacting with the companies. What have you found or implemented in a skill development, in a training, ongoing training? How are you helping either new salespeople get up to speed or keeping salespeople, other than the water cooler kind of ideas, like what have you found works well, like for that success?
It's a really good question as well. So there's sort of two things. I think one is we're trying to spend more time on asking the right questions, right? Listening. It's not about going in and presenting, here it is all about me. This is all, everything we do. The reality is it's about you. You're the customer, right? We're here to help you. We're here to help you understand how the solutions that we have can fit the needs that you want. When you get to a conversation with a customer, and again, views of my own, but my belief is it's about getting the customer to open up, which can be hard, right? You want to build trust that they feel comfortable. They can tell you things that won't come back to haunt them, right? That they can tell you things that you're not going to use to push on them, that, look, here are my needs. Here's what I'm struggling. Here's the pain that I'm trying to overcome or the problem I'm trying to solve. And then ultimately, can we help educate them on the things that others have done in a similar situation to solve for them? And if they do, there's a match, right? I think with newer hires, the tendency is to kind of come in and immediately lay your wares out on the table, break out your fuller brush and show them how it works, right? Those days are long gone. Immediately, the person on the other side of the table, their eyes glaze over and they're already like, how do I get out of this room, right? So it's about listening and making sure that people are really leaving the room when they're gone, understanding, yes, there's a need here, there's a fit, there's a match, we can move on. I think that's been number one. Number two, in particular in the world of financial services, you're seeing definitely more disintermediation where more firms are bringing in procurement professionals, right? Whose job it is to help bring the deal to a close. So once the business person has decided, yes, this is something we need, the procurement professional comes in to help get that deal closed. And they have a job, right? Their job is to get the best product for the lowest price, right? So we find that, you know, look, part of a good professional nowadays is to build relationships both with the business and with the procurement teams. Because procurement teams have a job, they have a goal, they want to look good to their managers, they want to show that they've gotten value for their purchase, and it shouldn't be a contentious one. And I find that, I think if you look out in the world, there's a lot of people who feel like that the relationship between sales and procurement should be contentious. And where we succeed the most, and again, this is my view as well, is when that's not contentious, right? When you are helping that procurement person find value, it's a terrible overused expression, but the win-win, right? Where they can get something at a value that's enables us, enables you as a business, right, to be professional and successful, and also enables them to show that they got a good value for their team. Those are the two biggest things, particularly in this market, that have been important.
Obviously, questions is key. I love that you pointed out versus that old, like, here's all my wares, here's my big sales pitch. I call it the monologue, yeah. Right? Walking in and giving the big monologue and chest thumping, and here's all our logos and our brands, and here's how amazing we are. And people are like, I don't care. Like, can you help me? Everyone only cares about themselves. Even if they're procurement at a company or a government agency, it's still just about them and whatever they're dealing with. So I love that, leading with the questions. And then the other part is interesting, which is making it the win-win. And that fits with what you've been saying this whole time, which is about the relationships. It's about the long-term versus the transactional. The transactional salespeople and companies dislike when procurement's involved because now they have this battle in their mind, they're thinking, because they're so transactional, they usually lose those battles or it becomes an RFP. And then they're having to give away the farm to get the deal because they're transactional, right? It's kind of a chicken or the egg, but it's really that they're transactional instead of relational.
And I find there's some really amazing procurement professionals out there that I've worked with over the years that really understand the balance between a long-term relationship, which becomes a partner over time, and those both in my prior life and my current life that some I still deal with today that they're just really good at it. They know, hey, look, I'm driving to get value for my company. I also know I want to have a healthy relationship with my vendor, and they're able to sort of strike that unique balance. And there's some really, honestly, it's the unsung career out there, but there's some really amazing folks in that profession that do an amazing job at saving their company money, but also building really good long-term relationships with vendors over time. So again, a trend that I see continuing without question.
And on one side, it's tough because I see that part of the reason why procurement professionals are needed, especially in organizations, is because sales has historically set up this model where the salesperson is looking out for their interests. And if the company's not careful, they're going to overpay or buy something they don't need or not get what they needed long term. So they kind of have this defensive mechanism built into the process to ensure they don't lose, which is sad. Now, what you're saying is the positive side of that, which is organizations sometimes just need help from a professional who does this and knows is looking at it long term, which people like yourself that, let's say, are working with a procurement professional like that, that's a home run, because you're long-term, they're long-term, then it's like about solving problems and not about the transactions.
Yeah. And I find that the best folks out there, like, put themselves in the shoes of that procurement professional that's at the table and able to see what their job is and able to see what their goals are. And when you could put that lens on, it helps. There's no guarantees. Look, sometimes you get to a point where, hey, we can't come to an agreement, but it's rare. I think when you unpack on both sides, okay, what is the structure of a relationship that's going to be successful for both sides and willing to open up? You can usually get somewhere. You can usually figure out, all right, you could change aspects of a deal here and there to make it work for both sides. There's always some kind of lever you can pull to help make it work.
That key is putting yourself in the other person's place, right? That empathy side, as I call it, which is understanding what their situation is, understanding what that procurement, that marketing manager, whoever you're selling to, what might keep them up at 2 o'clock in the morning, or what they're always thinking about or worried about that their boss might come in and ask them about or put them on the spot about. And then how can you help relieve that? Again, in any transaction. And then when you do enough of that with somebody, it takes the personal side out of it, where it's like me versus you on a personal basis. And if the deal doesn't happen, it's just the nature, but it's not because you didn't like me. It's because it just didn't work, right? Which is a totally different feeling.
And when you think about it, like, put yourself in the position of the person buying, right? They're making a choice to invest either for themselves, if you're buying an individual product, or if you're in a business on behalf of the firm that you represent. Could be a small amount of money, could be a significant amount of money, but if you're representing other people and you buy something and that service doesn't work out, it doesn't meet the need of the business, or it doesn't work, you've put your neck on the line as a professional. Mm-hmm. So you're here to help them make that journey comfortable, to make it easy so that they feel confident that, hey, I've signed my name, I want to buy your product, I've taken it into my home or taken it into my business, that, wow, it's better than I thought.
Yeah.
I look smarter because I've made this choice, as opposed to the other way. Was it the CLM, the career limiting move, right? You never want to have a customer, I bought this and you've ruined my life. Like, you tell them where to make them look good, right? What's going to help them improve their business? They don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah. So always make your customer, no matter B2C, B2B, doesn't matter. Always make them the hero in the story. Always make them feel and look like the hero afterwards, because they're always going to share it with somebody. Even if you sell something to a consumer, to an individual, spouse, a family member, a friend, somebody's going to judge them based on their purchase, and they're going to either feel like they won or feel bad about it. And it's so funny you say CLM, career limiting move. I haven't heard that since I worked at Microsoft in 2000 to 2002. There was two things they warned everyone, the CLM and the CEM. CLM might be like saying something wrong or doing something in a meeting or messing up something. CEM, which is a career ending move, generally fell on reply all emails from the boss, but then you thinking you replied to one person and you said something really stupid and offensive, but you replied all to Microsoft and then you're done. That was the CEM. Funny side note. So shifting just a little bit, what do you think of when you hear the word authenticity?
I think of it as, I would say, mainly from the individual perspective, but an experienced individual, when you meet them, you're seeing exactly what you get. Right? You're seeing the person that you're dealing with is exactly the person that they are when the mic is off, when the camera's off, when they're in the back room, no one's watching. That's what I think about authenticity. And I think that, again, it comes down to talent. I find some of the most talented professionals in this space are ones that are authentic. They're like, there was one individual I remember, it was the prior firm I worked for. I think he might still be there. To me, he stole the model of a professional salesperson. He was just, didn't matter where you met him. In a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning, in a client conference room, he was always the same person and you knew what you were getting. And that was authentic. And you're like, that person I would buy from. So
I love it. What about when you hear the word persuasion, or you've seen what you feel about persuasion in the sales process?
Yeah, that one's still, it's funny. And I think putting the two together is what's brilliant about the title, because persuasion by itself still smells snarky, right? It still smells like there's some secret technique that you can use to persuade people that it cast a voodoo spell. Yeah. And they don't exist. Everyone thinks, oh, wow, you're in sales. There's no technique, right? There's no magic word that all of a sudden, you know, their eyes glaze over and they're buying from you. You have no idea what happened. Authentic persuasion is about, I feel like when you put those two together, it takes the sort of that snarkiness away. It's about creating an experience or having an experience with someone who you're seeing the experience or the sale or the product or service for what it is. And there's a natural process to helping them understand why it's a good product or service to buy. So
I love it. When you were growing up as a kid, what did you want to be? I'm going to guess not a global sales leader or maybe a computer programmer, but what is it that you wanted to be?
I actually wanted to run my own gym, believe it or not. So I am so far from where I'm supposed to be. And then in college, I actually did want to run my own shop. So I ended up doing that really early on. I found a bunch of colleagues and friends that shared the same vision. So I always wanted to run my own computer consulting firm. I did it for a while. But yeah, originally I wanted to run a gym. I wanted to start a fitness center. So that's a long way out.
I love it. Yes, that's definitely a windy path from there. What is your definition for success?
That's a tough one. I think it's different for everybody. I think it's a balanced life where you're doing what you want to do and you're spending time with the people you want to spend it with. I think there's too many people that work too long and their personal life suffers. I think there's too many people who don't spend enough on their professional life and that suffers. I think there's a balance in everything. And I think if you're sort of in the space that you want, pursuing the dreams that you want, and you're spending time with the people you care about, I think that's about as good as it gets. And I think financial reward always follows, right? I think if you're pursuing it just for that alone, inevitably you end up miserable because you're doing it for the wrong reason. So
that's amazing and so succinct. I really appreciate that. Last question, the journey or the destination?
Journey, no question. You realize you love the journey, then you get to the destination. You're like, what am I going to do next? Oh my God, I don't want to do it myself. So it's definitely a journey.
It's almost like the journey with pit stops, right? Or roadside breaks. You're always going somewhere, but you're just taking these little stops.
Exactly. It's funny because my wife and I are huge. We love to travel. We've always traveled with the kids ever since they were little. And sad to say, but like some of the most exciting part of the trip is when you're getting on the plane to leave. And the vacations are always great. You love it when you get there, but you realize like you hit this peak when you're getting on the plane. You're like, what's going to happen? So it's always the journey without question.
Well, and what's fascinating if you really extract it is when you do that and you go on that vacation, you go to Hawaii or Mexico, when you get there, then you're still on the journey because it's like, what are you going to do now? You don't just go and then sit in a dark room and stare at the wall. I've arrived and I'm just going to wait until I fly back home, right? It's like, okay, the destination is then the next cue for the next journey. So that's fascinating. I love it. Matt, thanks for joining me on this conversation. For people who want to find out, again, disclosure, reminder, this was all Matt's opinions from Matt's experiences, in no way reflect his company. So I thought I would throw that on your behalf as well.
Thank you.
But if people are interested, the company you work for, Institutional Shareholder Service, they can go to issgovernance.com. They can find it there. Any other places to find you or anything that you're putting out there for you, sales, team, business?
No, I think certainly the firm I work for, I'm a raging fan of things we do. It's mission driven. And I think there's a lot of what we do is helping to make the world a better place in terms of things like ESG. So there's plenty of stuff out there. And I'm sure for folks who want to find it, there's plenty of content for them.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.